thank you for coming to this first Sundays with the Modern, dealing with our special exhibition, Gehinde Wiley, A New Republic. I ask first, before we get into the talk, that you turn off or turn your cell phone on silent. My name is Erin Starr White. I'm Assistant Curator of Education here at the Modern for Docent Programs. And this afternoon, it is my privilege to introduce Harold Stewart, Arts Administrator and Theater Practitioner, who's here to share his thoughts on the special exhibition Gehinde Wiley, A New Republic. Harold wears many hats. He's Creative Development Director of Stewart Cultural Development Group and the co-founder of the Director of Marketing, and the co-founder and Director of Marketing for the Next Gen National Arts Network. He also serves as the Performing Arts Coordinator for the South Dallas Cultural Center and Artistic Director of Fahari Arts Institute, a multidisciplinary Black queer arts organization in Dallas. As an educator, Harold has taught and led trainings on creative dynamics, the theater of the oppressed, as well as arts integration for various educational organizations. He is the recipient of the Apostle Alex D. Byrd Empowerment Award, and that's with the Legacy of Success Foundation, and Best Theatrical Director, Dallas Voice Reader's Choice. He's also been recognized as an upstarter in the arts by D Magazine and as a notable queer local by Dallas Voice. I think you will find Harold's perspective on the exhibition adds depth and nuance to your own relationship with the work. Please join me in welcoming Harold Stewart.
All right, thank you, Erin. I'm going to try to stay away from the speaker. It's so interesting. First off, I started by listening to your own bio. It is very, uncomfortable, so I kind of I'm going to start submitting a list of my failures and let people read those as well. But I'm very grateful and honored to be here and kind of represent in this way. I do want to thank Erin White again and Terry Thornton and the staff and administration here at the Modern for the invitation. It's a big task. So she's highlighted, some of my personal work. I think working at the South Dallas Cultural Center and working for the city of Dallas, as well in other communities. So I don't need to go over my bio again, but I will, how many of you, this is your first time actually being in the space, you haven't seen the work, so I'm trying to figure out how we should do this. So how many of you would say you're relatively familiar with Gehinde Wiley? So for some people, this is all new. All right. I'll highlight a couple of things about his bio. So Gehinde is born in 1977 to a Nigerian father and an African-American mother in Los Angeles, California. In 1999, he gets a BFA from the San Francisco Art Institute and then an MFA from Yale in 2001. And one description of his work says, Gehinde has challenged and complicated the tradition of European art and American portraiture and brought issues of race, poverty, and politics of representation to the fore in our cultural conversation. And you can really see that if you look at this work. I think this is kind of quintessential what Gehinde is known for. His kind of rise to notoriety is seen in this work, and it kind of highlights the works that I will be talking about. I first encountered Gehinde's work in the summer of 2009. So I was doing research for Fahari Arts Institute, trying to create this space for Black queer artists and individuals. So I was really, really interested in what cultural products were out there, what Black queer men, lesbians, bisexual, transgender individuals were doing. And so in my research, I came across Gehinde's work. I saw my first Gehinde piece a couple of years after that at an art market downtown, art fair downtown. And I think what drew me to the work was the scale, right? So seeing it on a computer is one thing, but really being engrossed by the work and standing next to it, you're like, oh, whoa. So even for me, it really is captivating and things like that. So I approach this work not as an art historian, not as an art critic, not as a Kehendeologist, or none of those things. I'm a cultural worker, I'm a cultural critic, and I'm a cultural organizer, and I'm happy, really excited to represent in this space in those ways. Kehinde's work, like many works, it invites the viewer to engage. So what I'll be sharing today, as Aaron said, are my thoughts on the work. So it's not necessarily what Kehinde said, but all good works of art, you know, you're allowed to analyze and you're invited to think in that way. Last kind of introduction piece, and I know they're like, can we go in? No, thank you. We're going to get there. I just feel I got to set up all of these things. So I was trained in the Black Baptist Church. Anybody familiar with the Black Baptist Church, Black Baptist tradition? So early on, public speakers that I heard were all Black ministers, right? So I kind of adopted that model, which is not necessarily good, and it's Sunday, and I'll try not to preach, but every kind of Black public speaker I know is a preacher. So just bear with me, you know, as we work through those kind of issues. It's a survey of work. There's a lot of work in here. We won't get to all of it. I think that I'm kind of like an expert on Black males because, you know, I get to be one and I get to like them. Sometimes I love them and things like that. So those are the works that I will try to focus on, and then hopefully together we can get through them. So I'm going to offer some thoughts, but this is a conversation. I believe in theater of the oppressed and the pedagogy of the oppressed, where there's a lot of knowledge just in this space. So it won't just be me talking and engaging. So welcome, thank you again, and let's come in. So this is Terry Thornton. I don't know if she heard my shout out. Okay, well, I'll shout her out again for the invitation. I'm very, very grateful. I'll also say, if you haven't had an opportunity to explore the work, I think with the microphone, you know, please don't look at me, look at the work. I'll get nervous. And I'll point out the works that I'm kind of highlighting and things like that. So I said, you know, I'm trained under and by observing a lot of Black, particularly Baptist preachers. So as a good Baptist preacher wannabe protege, this has a title and a subject, so I'll be speaking from the title, Queer Masculinity and the Black Male Invention. All right, here we go. So Thelma Golden, who was the first Black curator at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York, and who sparked controversy in 1994 with an exhibition she entitled Black Male Representations of Masculinity in Contemporary American Art, which depicted over 29 ethnically diverse artists and their concepts on Black masculinity. In the catalog created for the exhibition, there's an essay that Golden writes. The essay is entitled, My Brother. And in that essay, Thelma Golden says these words, "One of the greatest inventions of the 20th century is the African-American male, invented because Black masculinity represents an amalgam of fears and projections in the American psyche which rarely convey or contain the trope of truth about the Black male's existence." And I think about that, and I think it's in relationship to Kehinde's work and in studying things here around this notion of the 20th century Black male invention, and actually who gets to invent Black men and Black male identity. A question to the audience is, you know, where do you receive your information of Black male life and Black male identity? First question is participatory. I know some of you, so I'll call your names. Clyde.
The media.
All right, media. Other ideas of where we receive information around Black male identity, especially in America.
Personal experience.
Personal experience, someone said music. Okay. Other thoughts and ideas? Art, sports, the government,
family,
friends. from black men, okay? So I think it's easily arguable, right? Black male identity, especially in the current context of which we live, a lot of us receive it, like you said, from the media, sports, and things like that, but we don't necessarily control media, right? We don't necessarily control the ideas. Who would you say then kind of controls the ideas around media and black thought? Powers that be, can we get more specific? Oh, okay, so maybe some people say, I arrive at the question, cisgender white men, a white power structure, right? White wealth and all of those things control white media, control white media, but actually control the media that then gets to inform us about black lives. So I lead with Thelma Golden, I lead with her work, I lead with that exhibition, one, because I believe that Kehinde is very familiar with that work, you know, while he's studying in Yale, because it caused quite a controversy. The Whitney is a white institute, and to fill the floors with all of these different concepts and ideas about black male identity, some of it homosexual identity, and a lot of things, you know, there are things about OJ and things like that, caused quite a national stir. So you cannot be a working artist and interested in black male identity and not familiar with their work. But I also lead in that way because in 1998, Thelma Golden leaves the Whitney to become the chief curator of the Studio Museum in Harlem. And then by 2000, she's not only the chief curator, she's also the executive director of the Studio Museum in Harlem. And one of the things that Golden says when she takes over the institute is that she wants to rethink it. She wants to reimagine it as a think tank, not just an institute, right? So meaning that the artists that come here, the audience that come, should be engaged in some kind of critical inquiry around black identity, black life, and things of that nature. In 2001, after graduating from Yale, Kehinde finds himself as an artist in residence at the Studio Museum. So Golden has been there since 2000, and so Kehinde finds himself kind of at the beginnings and the onset of this rethinking of the museum. It's where he creates some of these works that we see here. So if you look at, I think it's Mugshots in Blue is what it's called, Mugshot Profiles in Blue, and then the Mugshot Studies, they come out of that residency at the Studio Museum in Harlem, where Kehinde has even said himself, you know, that's where he really explores this idea, where that's where the rest of this work kind of comes from. If you look at this work in particular, Mugshot Study, the story behind it is Kehinde leaves the Studio Museum in Harlem. He picks up this piece of paper as he's walking, and it's actually a wanted poster from the NYPD of this brother. And Kehinde sees it, and he doesn't see a kind of wanted individual. In many ways, he sees himself and a reflection of his community. The MSNBC anchor and Arthur Turay writes about this piece. And I love what Turay writes about it. He says, sometimes I wonder if there's an agency somewhere. Let's call it the agency with a multi-million dollar budget and a 24/7 imperative to damage the image of the black American male and remind you he's a fearsome beast, the criminal black male. They carefully cultivate him like a strange fruit because he's valuable for sowing fear. Why see an individual when you can see them all, right? And so in a lot of conversations, we talk about the actions of one black individual representing the whole race. So maybe there was some kind of crime committed or things like that. But then he becomes the face of black male identity in our hearts and our minds, perpetrated by the media and other things that we see. Turay also says, Kehinde insists on seeing something differently, right? So he says, everyone knows black boys and innocents are as different as apples and spaceships, but damn if the boy in this mugshot study doesn't look soft and vulnerable and wounded and still growing, right? So again, if you look at it, the way Kehinde has captured him, it is kind of the beginnings of him re-exploring and re-imaging black men and black male identities. So I'll offer up some time before we go over to the next gallery if you want to look up at it closely before we proceed. The 5-year kind of gap. You know, I thought about it because as the, I'm trying not to be in the way. When you first read it, you think, you know, he graduates, he goes to Studio Museum, one day he walks out, like it all happens in this gap of time. And I don't necessarily know why the gap in time, but it's interesting. I think, again, what's interesting about these two different pieces, especially in the mugshot series, this, we can't see the face of this individual. I think the hair is very intriguing. I think this piece he creates as his kind of thesis show for Yale, so he is exploring, again, maybe hair and some other things. And I don't necessarily know what has happened within the 5 years that maybe he finds this and evolves into this kind of mugshot kind of idea. But it is an interesting gap of time, but it's also an interesting positioning of the individual where you can kind of see him, which I think is critical in Kehinde's work. Kehinde could elect to erase the faces, right, and still give you black male identity. But for a lot of people, these individuals are recognizable, right? When I did the first walkthrough, the curator who helped organize the exhibit here talked about Kehinde drawing Michael Jackson, and Michael Jackson being the only kind of famous person he's known to draw. But then I find issue with that because one of my friends, Terrence Nance, has been a subject for Kehinde, and he has films produced by Jay-Z and things like that. And I bring it up just to say fame is not is relative, but also by making their faces known, I think for me it presents even a different type of risk in terms of association. I think we'll deal more with that when we talk about queer masculinity and things like that. Any other questions before we leave this gallery? If not, I think we can step over here to the middle. Oh, no, you're welcome. And really, people engage with the work. There's an invitation to, like, I feel some kind of way that it's like I'm keeping you from the work. They're large enough and they're in charge enough for you to engage. My voice will carry. My voice will carry. Do we have? Oh, because I'm so loud. But they're recording. Yeah, yes. All right, a couple of other people. So this, again, like I said, is kind of the aesthetic many people associate Kehinde with. It is the aesthetic and the works that I first encountered when I became familiar with this work. And it also is the work that helped him kind of rise to fame. It's interesting because at an initial thought, I have a lot of initial, as a queer man of color, I have a lot of initial thoughts with the works, with what they kind of bring up for me and what they may represent in larger society. And I think, you know, this is about 4 or 5 pieces of hundreds, right? Oftentimes, when Kehinde finds a subject, he'll take over 100 pictures. So it's not uncommon for these individuals to be positioned differently in other pictures and kind of there throughout the world. Again, I was introduced with this notion of queer masculinity, which for some people, it's like those words don't really go together because queerness is seen maybe as non-male, sometimes as soft. But then there's this notion of the queer masculinity of straight man. And there's a theorist and a professor who comes from the Indiana University of Pennsylvania His name is Robert Heasley, and he writes in an essay, The Queer Masculinity of Straight Man, that many straight men experience and demonstrate queer masculinity, which he defines as a way of being masculine outside of the heteronormative constructions of masculinity, and that they also disrupt the potential traditional images of hegemonic kind of ideas and thoughts. One of his chief complaints and arguments is that, you know, gentlemen are actually individuals who don't identify as straight are allowed to be queer, right? They're encouraged to be queer, and they're often read as queer even when they don't identify as queer. They may identify as gay or lesbian and things like that, but just their sexuality disrupts what we think of normative sexuality, so they're labeled queer. But he said when you take queerness outside of sexuality and its disruption and other ways that queerness can be disruptive, then straight men do not have the same type of representation when you look at what queerness can be, right? So for me, when I look at these paintings, I read them as very, very queer, right? Even though the thoughts and beliefs of what we think about these individuals, we read them as heterosexual. But by the way in which Kehinde positions them, again, by the iconography behind them, maybe some of the softness of it, of facial expressions and things like that, if I ask my sister, right, so what do you think about these brothers in these pictures, she'd probably say they're gay, right? And I, you know, and what would make you feel like that they're gay? And she would say, well, just look at them, right? And I would, you know, challenge her even more to say, I'm looking at them. Still, why do you feel that they're gay, right? My argument is that their sexuality really doesn't matter. What matters is why you view them and automatically associate them with a particular sexuality, right? I think Kehinde representing gentlemen in this way kind of counters the chief argument that Heasley makes, and it gives them a place of being. It gives queer masculinity and the queer masculinity of straight men kind of a home. And it really invites us to engage and to think and to wonder, you know, who controls, again, our thoughts and ideas around masculinity, around queerness, and how is that information fed to us? How does it, you know, show up in the ways in which we create stigma, right? To people who may identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, and even how does it separate us from individuals who may represent this way in everyday life? A couple of other things that I would say, even around the definition of masculinity. So masculinity is most commonly known as the behaviors and attributes of people who are either biologically male or associated with male and things like that, and really traditional roles, right? But to me, it's controversial because masculinity does not look the same throughout the world, right? So if you go to Europe or non-Western places, masculinity is allowed to look very different. And Western people will view it very different. So again, by Kehinde taking mostly European paintings and European poses and things like that, and positioning American urban black men, and that it creates this kind of conflict between masculinity. And for me, it complicates the ideas of what masculinity is. And it really, it makes me wonder, again, who controls it? Why do we think these ways? And is there room for new thought? Is there room for evolution of thought? Things like that in an American context. There's a documentary that is around Kehinde doing some of the work on women that's called An Economy of Grace, right? And in this documentary, one of Kehinde's creative partners, finds him a barber to cut his hair in the studio. And the barber is, you know, black, male, looks like he's in his 30s and 40s. And in the studio, he's cutting Kehinde's hair. And this is the first time, you know, they've really encountered each other. So Kehinde shows him some of his work. And Kehinde says, well, what do you think about the work? And he shows him works that looks like this. And the barber, with all the respect that he can muster up, says, it's a little too rosy to be hood. And you understand what he's getting at, right? Like, I see it, I recognize it, but there's something about it that throws it off for me, right? I often think about, standing in this space, where else have I seen maybe the queer masculinity of straight men, in particular black straight men? I think about my brother. I remember, going to our grandmother's house, and he has all daughters. And one day my brother is in the kitchen combing his daughter's hair, and it causes me to stop because my brother is very, quote unquote, masculine. He's very heterosexual, but without a thought, when his baby girl says, Daddy, I need you to comb my hair, he figures it out, right? I often think about, there's videos going around on Facebook and social media of a young man, a little brother, seeing his bigger brother get out of jail for being in jail a period of time. And the way they embrace and hug and kiss, again, disrupts this whole notion and these things that we think about in terms of masculinity, and actually queers it because it doesn't fit into the norm of what we've been associating with masculinity. Any questions about this work and things? Just feel like I'm talking, yeah.
In all of these works, can you speak to the idea that we're making eye contact with them and what their eyes are telling us?
Well, and so again, I think the wise decision that Kehinde makes to make them large, right? And sometimes you have to look up to them and things like that. I don't necessarily know what the eyes are telling, but there's a way in which you can't escape them. And if you do escape them, you have to wonder what is causing me either to be drawn in or to go away from them. Again, so as I was saying in that space, he could have made them faceless, right? Or he could have mixed up some faces and manipulated them so that you didn't recognize them. But there's a certain power and a certain risk, again, because these are real people. So Kehinde, if you're not familiar with his process, he does this thing called street casting, right? So where he walks out on the streets, sometimes in Brooklyn, sometimes in Harlem, and just sees a brother, walks up to him, and he has, depending on, who it is, his way of approaching him and asking him to be a sitter in one of these paintings, right? Which to me is very risky, right? Kehinde identifies as a black gay man, right? And he's even said, oftentimes, he approaches guys that there's some kind of interest in, initially. But then, once he explains the process, they go through taking a series of photos and then him selecting which work, to paint based off of, or how to position him and pose him based off of, what he feels from them. And it's also, what's also interesting about the process is that it doesn't all happen in the same day, right? So there's some initial contact made and then you come back for the studio session, right? And Kehinde tells them what's gonna be done and to dress, as they see fit and appropriately. And this is how they come, right? So to be in a Kehinde Wally painting, this is, how I wanna be represented and things like that. So kind of this uplifting of culture as high art, especially urban kind of street culture and things of that nature. Other questions? This, I think, for me, this piece, one of the gallery attendants, I think they were doing a poll. So when I walked in here earlier, they said, well, which one is your favorite piece? And I said, well, that's a hard question because I've been kind of studying some of them before this lecture. So I don't want to say one because, it's at the forefront of my mind. But again, this piece here, one, because of scale, the placement of the flowers and what they associate with. But again, if we talk about positioning, softness, and facial expressions and things like that, I have to say this one is my favorite because it causes the most questions for me, right? Not necessarily because of execution or, he's just pretty or I like his tattoo, but again, this very vulnerable state of being in terms of lying down and things like that. And then there's, if you really want to talk about the eyes, Aaron, there's something in these eyes that, you know, would even cause me to kind of walk away and turn away, because there is this innocence that's tied back to the piece that we see early on, the mugshot, where Kehinde and Teray ask us to see, you know, when you see a mugshot, look deeper. Like, what else do you see? This is my good friend, Tim Wilson. And so Tim has kind of helped me analyze art. He went, where did you go? You know what quote I'm going to say? The favorite one. Oh, he was at the Dallas Contemporary, and I think someone told him, you know, art is about look, what do you see? Look again, what else do you see? And then begin to break it down, and then you can analyze it. So this picture for me has a lot of things to look at, to reexamine. You know, also, you know, there's this little play here. Again, I told you I identify as queer, so we got that out the way, right? So there's this also, you know, showing of skin and underwear, and what does that really mean, right? In relationship to this person, in relationship to this piece, but then also in relationship to the work that is kind of modeled after, right? Because again, is it really more around maybe sexual attraction or intimacy that's not necessarily represented in the original piece? So why then is it allowed, right? Or why, you know, is it there? Or what does it have to inform? Does it inform something about the original piece, or does it just kind of change the narrative? And even what's the belt buckle and things like that. Other questions? I feel like I talk a lot. Y'all are quiet, but I told y'all this was church. Can y'all say like, amen? Yes, Clyde.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Just wondering what you think about the juxtaposition of this Renaissance, very Western, portrait setting juxtaposed against a hyper-urban portrayal, and who's that serve in terms of back to the notion of white supremacy and the validation of this work?
That's why I love you. You know how you say me and Sarah always ask those critical questions and push you to that place? That's what you're doing now, right there. Because it is there, right? So some of my maybe critique of the work is how are the subjects served, right? And then who benefits? I think what Clyde's saying, you know, from this aesthetic, right.
But you know what, so in Brooklyn, I was thinking about the Renaissance piece and like the Harlem Renaissance, but there, this time period, also there was a Brooklyn Renaissance, a culture Renaissance. And even with Terrence, the other folks who are Khalif Wali, right, some of the other people who are also cultural producers who show up in his work, I think it's also canonizing a time period and a cultural production that was site-specific.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but it does still stay in line with this Western notion of power and reinforces this legitimacy.
In many ways it does. And even more so, I think, in the female work, right? Because then they take on the one of the liberating things about the male work that's not that doesn't happen in the female work is that they're able to select their own clothing, right? So they're able at least to have some kind of representation in their garments, where the females are wearing, Tim, I'm going to get it wrong. Don't give me, you know, clearly I'm not a fashion person. What's his name? Givenchy, right? So they're wearing, you know, these Italian dresses and things like that. All the hair is processed. In Economy of Grace, you can see the women that he also street cast. And there's one sister, like, she agrees to it, but she's taking her time to get fully with it, you know? And she appreciates the dress, but when they start offering up this other hair that's not really hers, because she picks her hair every 2 weeks and things like that, there is this conflict between the subject and the artist. And again, I think watching Economy of Grace is where I really saw, okay, there is some kind of cultural erasure that goes on as well. Even in the process, And maybe it doesn't serve the subjects or the culture as much as it could, right? Are some of my thoughts around it. But going back to this idea of this, you know, queering, so to speak, or this queer, the queer masculinity of straight men, and the things that I think around, I think because we also have no control over masculinity, how it's defined, and how it plays out in our community, so there's a limitation to who Black American men can be in this world, right? There's often this pressure to fit in into these notions of ourselves that are not ourselves, right? Because we erase ourselves from the wholeness that we can have, right? That we can be vulnerable, you know, that we can have different attributes and behavior, and it has nothing to do with our sexuality. So again, to me, that further goes to serve maybe a white power structure, but it's also used to criminalize Black men. I mean, it's kind of a byproduct, right? Where you see criminalization. So again, if you're denied, you know, the wholeness of yourself, if you're not even introduced to it, right? And anytime you encounter something different, something that may be perceived queer, something that's not normative in society standards, you begin to feel disempowered, right? That maybe I am different and maybe I am queer. Do I like men? You know, you begin to question yourself, and there's all kind of mental things that happen, right? There's all kind of reactions, you know, to denying, you know, and limiting identity. So for me, so the picture there that we start with, right? So it becomes a common practice then to go outside in Harlem and find mugshots of Black men, right? Because what we do to Black men here, right? So in terms of limitations and identity, right? So then it drives this kind of maybe criminal nature.
So you speak about
scarring.
About the, I guess from the perspective of how it looks, and as a performing artist, I can look at it and I can see certain things regarding sexuality in the body itself. Like you mentioned, like the skin being exposed, or I'm looking at like how he's posed. So for me, it's one of those things to where you know, the actual look of what he has on is not even in, is not parallel in, you know, his body position and what the body is saying. So I think also it can start a conversation about, you know, here's this guy that is dressed the way, quote unquote, a masculine man should be, or a man who identifies with himself as masculine, yet his body language reads something completely different. And so then what becomes socially acceptable? Is it, you know, the body language itself, or is it what he has on, or do we not accept any of it at all because of the body language?
Well, and I guess for me, the question then, I again, pushing it a little further or complicating, is that how do clothes then get to be assigned masculinity and fit, right? How do clothes then get a sexuality, right? And things like that. It goes back to the barber's comment around, it's a little too rosy to be hood, right? Are there not roses and hoods? Or things like that. So, you know, to me, the it is not the thing, but it's the why. Why do we think that way, right?
And then just even when you spoke about, like, look at it and look at it again, look into his eyes, like, as I look into the picture again, I see more uncertainty. You know, even the person posing, you know, may have some questions.
All right. Yeah, I often think that the subjects, again, sometimes the way it's positioned, you know, you want to be a part of this work. But even, I would be interested in what the subjects think after they see the work, right? After, you know, some of those accounts and how they may feel and things like that. Most of it is pretty true to the posing, but there's not necessarily a background assigned to it after the posing and things like that. So again, it becomes a risk in terms of what we think around masculinity in America and Black male identity. To me, it becomes a reward because it gives us an opportunity to complicate queer masculinity, Black male identity in America, and have conversations like this around it, and maybe then push people, right? And kind of liberate some of the individuals, right?
You know, one thing that occurs to me is the conversation going on is how much do we believe that Wiley is giving us the direct
representation of that photograph. I mean, where does artistic license come in as far as what we read from the painting? I mean, how he gets ready to take those eyes. Does he add anything to what he sees in that photograph?
Possibly. I don't have a photograph here. but I think from what we've been able to see, you know, in videos and in this process, most of the works that I've seen are pretty true to the photo. Questions I would have is like, how do you instruct someone, especially someone that we read as black and masculine, right, to look that way, right? So what were the prompts? What were, you know, all of that to even to get to this, right? Especially if this individual carries his masculinity in a certain way. So, like good research, the idea is to not answer questions, but create more kind of informed questions and things like that. So I do think that's the value of the work, right? That I leave wanting to know more, right? I leave wanting to even figure out why I think the way that I think and who controls those thoughts. And then if I don't agree with it, I leave wanting to counter some of the things that I've been fed, right? So I think that's the beauty of Wiley and some of the work and some of the pieces. Any other thoughts or questions? I don't know what time it is.
I think just a side note, an addendum. One thing that the subjects that I've seen just walking through the exhibit is the emotion in the eyes that comes out. That's one thing that they add that they can bring to the table is the emotions of themselves through their eyes. Tell a story in and of themselves throughout the
Yeah, and I would agree. Again, if we're looking at a replica, and if the subjects get a sense of agency to create this, then I would agree, right? If they're instructed to, then it may be a little bit different, right? Yeah. Yes.
Sorry to mention any of this. Well, just wanting to photograph question. I think it's most artists when they work from a photograph, they work to change it a little bit at least because otherwise why wouldn't they show the photograph? And I don't know if you talked about at all about his painting method. I was noticing the thing over there, it looks like it was done with an underpainting and some of these don't, so did you talk about
that? Nope, and I won't, because that's not, I'm more of a performer and critic, so I know he mixed colors well, that's about all I can say. You want to talk, anyone? Yeah, you can speak to the...
He is very much like the camera action. You do this, hold this. So it's a production.
Right. Other thoughts before we move on to maybe another gallery?
Well, who else gets hair really well?
Black men hair or black women hair?
Black hair in terms of, and then in cross medium. And I wonder who else.
Who else can execute hair really well? Well, and honestly, a lot of people, one of the things that being portraiture is that a lot of people, especially contemporary artists, have gotten away from creating portraiture, right? Especially realistic things, maybe because, I mean, what I do know about painting is that it's one of the hardest art forms to kind of create. It's not easy, you know, to mix colors, to set emotions, to do shading and tone and scale and things like that. So I would think that, you know, it is very hard even to get, you know, hair right. One of the things that comes up if you see the women's work is, you know, it is really more about the hair. Most people pay attention to the fingernail polish and the feet, things that get erased when we think about black men because, again, we're not looking necessarily at things that we associate with beauty. We're looking at things that we associate with masculinity. And so that's why I asked, you know, the female hair or the male hair, because again, most of the time the hair is very kind of erased in the male subjects. Except if you see Terrence's pictures, I mean, he has this large afro and green kind of sweater, but Kehinde and the graduate work that we saw first, again, the notions of hair are really important as a beginning. Okay. We're going to move on just for the sake of time, because we want to hit maybe two more galleries and leave time for other questions that we want to respect. So this is a part of Kehinde's World Series. I think if we come here, this is some of the work he did in Mali. I'll wait for people to come around. I have to say, if there's another work that I'm drawn to, one is this work. It is a doggone couple. One, because again, it's not in the Western sense in terms of, it comes from Mali, it's about Mali, it's about the doggone people, but the kind of muse, and Kehinde takes this from a doggone sculpture, a wooden sculpture, where the subjects are believed to be male and female, right? And it kind of this more traditional art, the sculpture, arts critics talks about the way in which its position is to create a sense of balance between the two, also intimacy and things like that. There is a essay in the book, and I forget who writes it, and he calls this Kehinde's queer couple, right? One, because of the intimacy between these two men, by Kehinde switching the subject, one subject and making them both male, it's kind of read that they are a couple. He calls them the doggone couple. And so you believe that they have some kind of same gender loving kind of relationship, which is a fair assessment. But also, for me, it's like, well, Kehinde's queer couple is not really queer at all. When we talk about the practice of boy wives in Africa, right? So when we talk about, if we look at queerness on in terms of sexuality, that there is this long-standing presence of same-gender relationships in African tribes and cultures for a variety of different reasons. Sometimes there was not just enough wives, right? But still stuff had to be done. So men would take on boy wives or other things. But it becomes very confusing in a contemporary context, because this is, you can still see this level of intimacy among heterosexual men in Africa right today, right? Because intimacy and masculinity, and when I talked about masculinity, it gets a little bit fuzzy and a little bit complicated, because there's Western notions of masculinity. In Europe, it looks different. If we talk about behaviors, and in Africa, it looks different. Still today, if you go to Africa, certain parts of Africa, men who have wives and families are engaged in similar ways, right? It is not uncommon to go to Africa and see men holding hands and walking down the street. And it has no read around sexuality, because they separate it so, right? So there's a way in which the queer couple doesn't get to be queer at all, but for me, when this piece is juxtaposed or in the same kind of space in the gallery with some of the American pieces, it's kind of a return to the original source, right? So it becomes this homecoming for then maybe masculinity for black men, right? Because we're talking about West Africa here, right? So we're talking about things that were stripped away during the transatlantic slave trade, and you know, before or after we got over here, and then Western thought began to infiltrate our minds, right? So again, to me, it's funny, and I'm just that queer always to be controversial, right? To always say, well, maybe that's not what it is, even though you said that's what it is. But again, I read it very much as, yes, this is the original source. This is homecoming. This is a return back to what we used to know, not necessarily in terms of sexuality, but in terms of intimacy and things like that. So imagine, you know, in our hearts and minds and behaviors and beings, what will happen if we kept this level of intimacy when we came to America. Maybe some of the thoughts and ideas we have around this queer masculinity of straight men may not necessarily be that, right? Again, because bonds and brotherhood and camaraderie looks very queer in Africa when we look at it with our American mind. But it's like, if you approach some people on some, you know, queer stuff, you might get got, because they have no idea what you're talking about. It's what, you know, if any of you followed in recent years what was going on with Uganda and many African countries, they have to publish the pictures of queer people because you cannot find them in the crowd, right? Everybody dressed the same, drag is drag some ways, everybody holds, you know, all this, that, and the other. So the only way to really identify a queer individual is somebody had to rat on them, you caught them in some act, and then the only way to sustain that is to publish them in the newspaper and things like that. So again, I think it's a great piece, you know, in its position in the gallery. I think it's a great piece for what we're talking about today to come back and say, you know, there was a time before time and there's a land, you know, kind of far away where what we see over there is different than what we see here. And to me, that's part of the answer, right? To go back to maybe what was original. Thoughts about this work? What was said?
Can you talk about dreams?
Between these two subjects or? Right. Well, I think a couple of things in age range. I think what's talked about in this work is this kind of survey on Black American, what's read as youth, or urban culture, which there's a certain age that I think, you know, kind of a hip hop generation, people after that, that engage in that culture, right? So I think, you know, if he painted men of a certain age, maybe older than hip hop culture and things like that, clothes begin to change, right? There might be a little more hesitation and things like that. So I think in terms of what he tries to do, even around urban culture, age becomes important. I think if we talk about the street casting, you know, this is maybe his age range of desire, right? Because he's very clear around some of the people I approach, you know, it's based on desire. That may not be the intent, but again, it's what draws a connection. And I appreciate that honesty. So that's what I would attribute to the age range. Right, and his age. Because Kehinde, and even in the other work, he talks about, I mean, I think what was really a pivotal moment for him is realizing, again, that mugshot thing, you know, affected him, but in some ways he had to see himself in his subjects, right? And really deal with some contemporary issues or things that I think he can relate to. And I think culturally, you know, depending on when you're born, it's like me and my father were light years away from each other, right? And some things that, and even if I you know, talk about queer men that I know of a certain generation that's older, where silence is the rule because that's the culture they grew up in, right? Where I'm just, you know, out loud every other day. You know, and it's just like, and even invite them to participate in that, and it's like, no, we grew up in a certain aesthetic, we've become accustomed to it, we've, you know, it's just not what we do. So, I mean, I think it would be an interesting show, it would be an interesting concept. I think the dynamics will change, say, if we have gentlemen in their 40s and 50s and things like that. And even their relationship to masculinity changes, right? Because demasculating Black men looks different in generations, right? So especially, yeah, right, so it looks different. I'm about to get on the soapbox. So yeah, but I think it is an interesting, you know, kind of maybe progression or idea. You using something? Oh, I thought Terrence was going to say something. I want to end in this gallery of stained glass windows, and then offer some more time for thoughts and questions. We can go by. You want me to go? Okay.
I thought you were.
Well, because I think trans is.
You rethought that?
No.
I mean, do what you want to do. You're doing an amazing job.
We can do.
It's up to you.
But I think trans identity brings us. So we'll go. So yeah. We'll, okay. So we'll end here and then that'll be like bonus. And I really do want y'all to just, you know, feel the gallery. I'll stand back here because these works, I think, invoke something different. One, because of the material, being stained glass. Also, again, when we associate stain, there's, you know, there's a different function of a portrait that's in a world-famous museum and things like that. But stained glass exists in different kind of cultural institutes. So again, the conversation kind of changes. At least it shifts a little bit for me when you talk about stained glass. Most of these works, I think, being in cathedrals and churches. And again, by changing the subject matter, making them, you know, black and urban, all the different thoughts and ideas that they can provoke. This is, I think, some of his latest work dealing with men. Most of these are dated 2014. So I don't necessarily know how far, you know, he would go into stained glass. I don't have a lot of thoughts about the stained glass. One thing, it's so interesting to me, what I think about him in relationship to the other things, and maybe because it's light and all, you know, I'm a theater person, so light has a function and things like that. Also, the names of the gentlemen's kind of being on plates and things like that. But there's a sense of kind of liberation that happens for me in this space and this subject. And if I look in the eyes and things like that, there is some longing, but I do see, especially with this brother right here, a sense of liberation. You also get a sense of, you know, how fashion has kind of changed and evolved, right? When we started with the early kind of urban fashion, there is no fur, right? There is no things like that. But moving from those works to 2014, you know, the clothes look a little more fitted. And there are some other things that, again, we can have a whole conversation around in terms of, you know, queer identity, even with straight men and things like that. But here I wanted to close and just offer up a couple of things for our consideration. After viewing all the works, right, and after having these, you know, thoughts in my head, I'm a Virgo, so I overanalyze everything. But I get to use this tool that I've been introduced called a Black Radical Imagination, right? And so often I wonder, again, and we started talking about the African works and, like, what would life be like, you know, if we got to hold on not only to the drum, or, you know what I'm saying, but the ways in which black men could show vulnerability, intimacy, and just life and live it holistically. But in this space, I also use my Black Radical Imagination again, and I wonder, you know, what would the United States look like, right, if black men were allowed to be free, all right? So there's no physical chains, right? But there are these systems in place. Again, we've talked a lot about, you know, power and control and, that we don't get to own, right? We've talked a little bit about the byproducts of that. You know, I contributed to mass incarceration. I contributed or identified as a criminalizing kind of deal. So what would the world look like, right? Because I love black men to a fault. If they could be free, if we could be free. And what is that, how do we kind of work towards that freedom? And a part of that freedom for me is restoration. I have a friend whose name is Charles Stevens. He's a cultural worker in Atlanta. And Charles does a lot of work around black queer men. And one of the things, he was here a couple of weekends ago, and he was saying, Harold, you know, black men, black gay men are always asked to be resilient. Be resilient. They are, you know, they note you for your resiliency and things like that. And he said, you know, you can't live in America. And now I speak to a larger context. I open it up for all black men. You can't live in America and get to a certain age without being resilient, right? Resilient. That takes some effort, right? It takes some enduring things. So now we have to continue to be resilient, but we also have to create room for restoration, right? So what does that kind of look like, right, in this space, right? Resiliency we can see all on over. But what does restoration for black men look like? And how is it tied to liberation and freedom? I'll end with a quote from Assata Shakur. And one of the reasons, again, because, you know, I think I'm a freedom fighter, right? Like, she's a freedom fighter. I think I'm a liberation worker. Like, she's a liberation worker. And I hope the work that I do is tied to creating that freedom for Black men, right? Some queer specifically, but then for the larger identity of Black men in America. What Asada says is, it is our duty to fight for our freedom. And this is kind of the war cry of the Black Lives Matter movement, right? It's our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains, right? So when I look at the works on these walls, when I look at the artists, the subject matter, I think Kehinde starts and helps us move towards that fight. So the fight is all in this gallery around Black male freedom, liberation, and restoration. Thank you. So we'll take a couple of questions, and then it's like a bonus piece. We'll talk about it if you want to. I didn't include it in here because, I mean, I think my thoughts, I wanted to try to be clear. It's a sermon, you know, when the pastor goes off on something they got nothing to do with, and you trying to get to brunch, it's just like, please go back to your paper. All right, so if you want to hear my thoughts about this one piece, we can do that.
My thought on this, you spoke about restoration, and you spoke about like freedom and liberation. I think one of the first things I walked into was that we can't disconnect from the feeling of religion that's in here. And so not necessarily religion in the space of a certain practice, you know, be it like Christianity or whatever the case may be, but religion is in the terms of we do certain things religiously, like brush our teeth religiously, and so we give high regard to that.
Yeah, and it's part of why I tie this, again, in this space, I don't want to talk too much about the works, but that feeling of liberation, right? Or maybe spirituality that's very different, you know, for me at least, with those works. And like you said, you know, important people get to be on the stained glass, right? And then you see them replicated, right, throughout, you know, important institutes. And so there's a way in which, by naming them, I want to know who these people are, right? I want to know more, because maybe I have more to work with in terms of their personal identity than I have there. So it does create this kind of like, you know, you come in here and it's like, right? So that's again why, you know, again, it's like, is this restoration? Is this free? Is God here? Like,
I mean, even when you speak about, you know, liberation as a Black people, going back to this idea of religion, like, that was our day to be free.
Yeah, and Bell Hooks asked this very, very important question, right? And it's something that, you know, even now I'm trying to figure out because I have this, you know, I love my place of worship sometimes. But the question she asked is, where is the healing place? Again, you know, there's a lot to even unpack within these walls, but that's why restoration is so important. Because resiliency, Audre Lorde says it this way, survival is not an academic skill, right? So, you know, there's a lot of socioeconomic kind of ideas around these people here, but the ability to survive ain't nothing they may have learned in any institute. It is, you know, this cultural thing. It is this, you know, street ethic and things like that. So again, so they have survived, right? They've been resilient, but again, now, and it's, I mean, it's just like, you know, I hinted on the Black Lives Matter stuff because if I go into police brutality and, you know, it's just like, you know, it is Sunday. I'm allowed one happy day because I got six other ones, you know. But again, restoration becomes very, very, it becomes critical in the lives of Black men, right? Yes. I have a question.
So, I think the subject matter is I'm going to take it there. So, I think it was Frederick Douglass who said, even within our liberation, there are chains.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I wonder about artist intent and then viewer takeaway.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that while it's trying to create a new black male narrative in the work, but I also wonder how much of the work also reinforces the idea of black males as subjects,
mm-hmm.
to be looked upon, to be gazed upon, to be taken apart. Even this work over here, Smile, is very reminiscent of the scene in Mandingo when they're going through the mouths and inspecting their teeth. So do you feel, or does he speak to some of the psychological reinforcements that may happen as just, you know, by happenstance of the work being within the walls of, as we spoke of earlier, a white media institute that is controlling and housing the work?
So I think, you know, black people are definitely differently, they criticize him differently than maybe white people. Largely, especially black cultural workers or critical thinkers, largely because of some of the stuff that you mentioned, because there is this kind of display of black life that, you know, that people kind of come, engage with, and then leave, right? And it becomes very, very risky. Does he speak of it? I can't say yes, and I haven't seen it. I haven't seen him speak. I think he has talked about, you know, the inclusion of black people in these institutes, like lifting up images. I mean, he speaks of his work in a very positive way, like most artists and things like that. So he highlights those. I haven't necessarily seen him address the criticism. Outside of, I think there was an essay that kind of focused on the queerness, meaning being read as, you know, gay and things like that, that was kind of shut down by the art community. Again, my responsibility, right, because I can control Harold Stewart most of the time, is, you know, what do I get to say about it, right? So why is my conversation at least raising up some of those issues for us to think about and things like that? Because the work is the work. And as an artist, what I can say, it is very, I mean, Erykah Badu says, and I'm keeping in mind I'm an artist and I'm sensitive about mine, right? But there is a risk when you put it out for public consumption and public, and even in our good intentions and things like that, we fail, right? Again, what we can say is that this is another example of how European thoughts and culture, white thought, influences our lives, even when you try to work against it or include, you know, I was at a workshop a couple of weeks ago, and they talked about white fragility, all right, or white guilt and things like that and how you deal with it when it comes up. And I say, well, sometimes I try not to create a space where it exists, because once again, I'm focusing my attention on, you know, dominant culture and how they're feeling when I could be liberating other people, you know. But it's hard because there are white allies. There's good intentions. You know, some of us didn't create the world we live in. We inherited it. And it is like every day trying to reverse some of the psychological, some of the practices of the transatlantic slave trade, white rule all over the world. Yes, Tim.
I think it's a challenge being seen, because a lot of times we're not seen.
Mm-hmm.
And so this gives space for you to be seen. And then once you put out work, you're not a topic anymore. So when someone releases, just say a press release or whatever, when the public receives that, just like these paintings, they're not in charge of their interpretation anymore. They put their heart and soul into it, but people are going to walk away. Like Joan said, when you look at a painting, what do you see? What tells you that? What else do you see? So then you can internalize that and take that back and have additional conversations. And hopefully get the meaning out of it. If not, at least the work is out there being seen instead of being hidden.
So, and just to complicate it, because that's what I do, they know me, so again, they used to, right? So again, being seen sometimes, being seen at what risk, you know, comes as a question. I go back to Clyde's general question, who does it benefit the most? But then I also think of Audrey. I mean, it is the complicated work of being an artist, especially when you want to provoke thought, right? What Audre Lorde says about it is, I've come to realize time and time again that that which is important to me must be spoken, made verbal, even at the risk of having it misunderstood and abused, right? So there's a thing that, you know, it's not like Ahende produces this work and then just goes away and hides. He still has ownership of it, right? Especially when he does museum talks, when he produces, you know. So it lives somewhere else, but he still, you know, is the rightful owner, right? And the actions that they create afterwards, right? Right? So again, and my thing is, and you know, I try to be consistent. If I'm going to question Kehinde, I'm going to question hip hop, I'm going to question, you know, I'm going to be consistent across the board. And maybe hold them at least to similar standards, or at least call it out whenever I see it, you know. I do think what happens sometimes when you kind of make it, right, into a large institute, you know, the first thing is that we're supposed to run and celebrate, right? Because nobody made it. Like, you're the few, the proud, the chosen. So at least we have to, like, we need to celebrate. It's cute. It's, you know, all this, that, and the other. And a lot of times we don't allow ourselves to be critical. And I think that only the, I'm sorry. Yes, sir. No, I talk a lot. I mean, I'm an hour plus. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, more or less, I just want to say, if you can pinpoint, like, Latin, you know, the theme over here with the arches, if you can pinpoint that time period and have a better description of that period and that identification with this persona, like, illustrated and, you know, just, translated to us as viewers, if you would not walk away with 1,000 words, we'll just all be on the same, you know.
If I could do that? Oh, I just want to be clear. If I can do that, or if a person can do, the viewer.
Just, I don't know, whoever wants to do it.
Oh, art historian. What was the question again? Can pinpoint some of the, I'm sorry? Oh, it's a comment. So pinpoint some of the other features in terms of art, right? And so I started by saying, you know, I don't approach the work as an art historian or even an art critic in those ways, more a cultural critic and things like that. But there are some kind of finite detailed things that even go into the process and the selection that I think, you know, there are resources out there and even resources in this institute that can address it better than I can. I know. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say that there's a trend in feminist work where the gaze is disrupted. Like, you can't just look on a subject as a spectacle or just for pleasure's sake, that it's disrupted in some way. Because women have been painted forever and ever as just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
This is the urban black male as a spectacle, or as something to be consumed by eyes that don't know the story behind it.
I think.
I'm just mumbling.
Like, definitely well said, and I think it's a critical question. But I also, you know, it depends on who you are as you approach the work, right? I think we're all at different levels. And some people can say this is a start, a critical cultural year. You know, it's hard. It is very, very hard. Because we see something, but we also see something else, right? And my thing is that I don't want to get in this space and just condemn the artist and just, you know, I want to uplift it. I mean, for one, to start an idea and complete it is a task, right? To provoke thought is a task, but it gets very risky.
Sort of off of that, I feel like
you know, we're talking about the way that it can be seen. But for feminist art and for women art, disrupting the gaze is very, very important. But I think here, you know, I'm a painter, so I want to know about painting technique. It is very technical, and gaze loss is very technical. So it's sort of feel like working to remove the, you know, almost his own hand in the painting. So it's like the message is very clear in that, you know, there's no painterliness, there's no sort of, not as much, you know, brought in as how like African art.
Mm-hmm.
Using the Western structure, you know, but presenting the African, you know, an African American. So I think that it doesn't necessarily need to have a need disrupted as much. It's more like he's an African American man who's presenting, you know, himself and his subject in a way
that kind of sees it.
It can be read in a, you know, in a bad way, because still working extremely hard to, you know, to show that everyone feels it. Whereas another artist, like Kara Walker, misread so easily. And
I would say read differently.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, especially if a white viewer sees it or a white viewer interacts with it. She had a big, you know, installation piece, and there was a lot of uproar over people taking pictures of it. And so,
or the way, it's not taking pictures. It's like you're posing, and you know, it's
yeah.
Right.
It was disrespectful, and it was hurtful. It was continuing that narrative.
But I think it also speaks into people's relationship with art, right? It's that, you know, I mean, especially now in a selfie, you know, it's like, do we know how to engage, right, with serious subject matter of various race or identity and things like that? One of the things, again, and this is a survey of work. But you can also see his evolution as a painter from the early works, you know. And I think, again, as an artist, I know he will, you know, talk about this process and spaces to create process are very important. I don't know if I said it in there, but I'll say it again. I just celebrate the opportunity for a black man to explore black male identity, right? And get it wrong, right? In some ways, but also have some resources for that. Again, because if what we know about ourselves is only fed through us through the media, and we never get an opportunity to sit in, and most of the times this space looks like somebody's living room, especially for gay men, you know, cultural spaces are not these big public, you know, museum kind of deals. They're very intimate spaces. So to have a space like the Studio Museum to be an artist in residence, you know, to explore black male identity is very critical, and even uplifting a narrative, right? Then my other thought is, well, where does this exist when it's not an institute, right? Because all of these gentlemen don't get to be artists in residence at the Studio Museum. But again, if I'm thinking more towards liberation and what's needed to be restored, then maybe creating more spaces for black men to just talk about black male identity, because it is so complicated. Like, we've inherited it. There's a lot of stuff to unpack. There's generational things that we got to deal with. I often say, I lifted up Thelma Golden because, again, it's, why does it take a Thelma Golden to have this controversial exhibit on black male identity? She's a black female, right? Why does Bell Hooks inform me more about my black male identity and masculinity than my father? Like, we never talked about my penis and the functions of it, and, you know, and Bell Hooks, smile, I know, don't have one, right? But she does create this book, We Real Cool, to talk, you know. So again, so oftentimes, because the ways in which in America we've been told to engage, we got to separate us, some subjects are off limit. You know, there was this whole cultural thing around no homo, where you had to justify an act as not homosexual when it was read homosexual. So again, just a space, you know, just to say, this is what I'm thinking, this is what I'm feeling, this is what I'm encountering, and the opportunity, again, to either get it wrong or to start or to evolve, right? I think is critical.
And I think that kind of plays on towards things like when someone else sees it or takes it, like they pretty much take like ownership of it as well with their perception. But his intent was just to get the conversation started, in a sense, you know, because I think it's called like propagating the work, you know, like, you know, when you see a certain thing, you know, anything kind of art, your takeaway is your propagation of it. Mm-hmm. So that keeps the art evolving.
Right.
You know, even as a dancer, you know, I don't want the piece to end when the curtain's over.
the conversations that go on.
Right.
It's still considered quote unquote.
Right. I think it's a difference between thought-provoking work and art for art's sake. And they have a place, right? But again, when you really, you know, I often say black people, we can't afford to create art for art's sake because there's so much stuff we got to talk about, right? And things like that. I do want to get to this bonus piece and respect people's time and people at, like, you know, this Sunday for them. They may want to go home. I love the staff. They were like, Harold, we told you an hour, not two. So this last piece over here. So Sarah asked a question around one that we passed. Why was it called Two Sisters? Because some of the European paintings are actually of women, so which is a whole nother thing around queering. So some of the men are posed like European women are posed, and the titles remain the same. Which again, you know, you read it like, why is it called Two Sisters and it's two brothers? Another kind of queering aspect of it. So this piece, and it may feed into our conversation that we've been having, and it may not. Another thing I think is critical that Kehinde creates the frames, right? So you can engage with them and see. So that's also a part that shouldn't necessarily be separated because some of them have, you know, important symbols and cultural things. But this piece, when I did the gallery tour, kind of walk around with Terry and some other people, and I stopped, and I don't remember what the conversation was about, but I automatically read it as like a trans piece. The title of it is Support the Rural Population and Serve 500 Million Peasants. And so again, learning from Tim Wilson, thank you, friend, how to, you know, look and look again. The one thing, in addition to the very kind of finite features in the face, to me, he's a very beautiful man. And with these distinct features, you know, I didn't done drag before, so I know if you already have some good cheeks, it's easy to just put some dust on them and go, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, I'm like, he would drag. I told you this is the bonus. So again, so when I see him, and I see him as, he, and again, you know, the colors, it's pink, and I think about this person of color in China and why. So I look at this medical bag, and I also think in the ways in which trans people escape America to transition. Because of access of resources. Now, Kehinde probably, I can't say that's what he was talking about, but again, my relationship to it, looking at the pinkness, looking at the cheeks, and then this medical bag of things like that, I wonder, it's like, did you try to, I almost kind of hope and kind of pray, because again, I talked about cisgender men really controlling, cisgender white men of considerable wealth controlling our ideas and thoughts around every other identity. And if you're not familiar with cisgender, people would say, how do you explain? So cisgender means biologically I was born a man and I identify as a man, right? So there's this identity that's trans man, where when you were born you had the sexual organs and you were deemed female, but you transitioned to be a male. So like, what's Cher's son name? I think that's one of the famous ones. Chaz Bono. And oftentimes we know trans women, okay, so we know Bruce and we get that, but trans men become very invisible in our society, right? Sometimes you can identify because I think male features are really harder to lose than female features are hard than, anyway. So trans men become invisible. And so I have a lot of black trans male friends. And when people know that they met, like, it's like they have all of these questions. And but one, because of lesbian masculine identity. So they think that, you know, we complicate sexuality and we don't, and gender, and we don't separate them. So you spend a lot of time saying, no, that's different. That's still a woman. She carries a masculinity different, but a trans man, they've, you know, transitioned gender-wise. So that was, so, but this is, I think, I could be wrong. I thank each and every one of you for your time, for your questions, and for just dealing, participating. I would say, again, if you have some kind of thoughts and feelings about the work, then a lot of the job is done. Invite people to come see the work. I think it is a shame not for it to be here and us not see it. I often tell the people at the Modern, not often, but every time I come, how much I appreciate this museum because they're not necessarily afraid of the tough subjects. I mean, they bring the Black gay stuff, they bring the Carol Walkers, they do, you know, it's like I drive 45 minutes, you know, to come engage in this way. So again, as an arts administrator, you just don't know what it takes to get this, especially on this level. I deal with like little bitty art on this level to get it here. So it is a shame for it to be here and us as a community not engage with it, right? And they've even made Sundays free. So yeah, so please bring people back. You know, seek answers to those questions. Come with your own set of questions. Do this with friends. I encourage Black men. And if you haven't seen the Black woman stuff, I encourage Black women to go over there, develop questions, but especially Black men to come and just see what comes up. Bring your father, bring your friend, bring your son, but don't just look at it and leave. Like, deal with some of that stuff, especially the uncomfort. Now that I'm 33, I'm running towards all of my fears. All right? All right. Thank you again.